Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, a compromise on the state's $30 billion budget seems to have been reached. Legislators in the Senate, legislators are scheduled to vote on it today, Friday. More banned books at area schools, at CMS, and in Catawba County. Service workers at Charlotte Douglas Airport march for better pay and better working conditions. And an unexpected turn of events in NODA as the deal to sell the Johnston Y falls through. What it will mean for that location's fate. Here to discuss those stories and more is WFAE reporter David Borax. Shamaria Morrison is education reporter for WCNC-TV. Alexandra Sands is a reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Eric Spanberg is managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome to you all. Welcome. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, months after the state's $30 billion budget for this fiscal year was due, lawmakers have apparently finally come to an agreement. It came down to, wait for it, a compromise among Republicans over Medicaid expansion and expanding casinos. On Tuesday, they planned on taking votes on two separate bills, one on the budget, the other on Medicaid and casinos. But because some conservative Republicans opposed both, that would have required Democrats to vote in favor. So that's when House and Senate leaders came to a realization. House Speaker Tim Moore.
Clearly there were differences of opinion, and at the end of the day we felt like this issue and no one single issue should hold up a budget.
Senate Leader Phil Berger.
I've learned that in an environment like that you're unlikely to make any progress, and so it was my belief that it was time for us to just move forward.
So by moving forward, Medicaid is in, casinos are out. Any surprise there, Eric?
I would say a little bit. Until we had that opposition that you mentioned from some in the Republican caucus, generally what Senate President Phil Berger wants, Senate President Phil Berger gets. And so I was a little surprised that it turned that way. Then again, you heard Berger himself say that sports betting, for example, has taken a couple of cracks before it's passed. And it is logical that they would likely come back with the casino proposal next year. And so in that context, it makes sense. I go back to what we've talked about a lot on this show, Mike. They originally thought they would be done at the start of the fiscal year on July 1st. It's not unusual for them not to have a deal. It is a little bit surprising given the fact that they have a veto-proof majority that it took this long to get done. But as you said, it looks like it's going to be done and done today.
Yes, Senate Leader Phil Berger was all in favor of expanding the casinos. He lives and represents a district that is close to the Virginia line where there are casinos, and he sees money slipping over the border. And he said that emotion permeated the debate, that facts almost became beside the point. What do you know? And he expressed confusion as to why some supporters of gambling, including sports wagering, had waged such robust opposition to the idea of casino expansion. Does anybody on this panel understand the difference? Why they would wage this war and not the others?
I don't really. I mean, I know that some people, or obviously some people, think there is a difference between having sports betting and having more casinos. Remember, there were also going to be 50,000 video gaming terminals as part of that. That may have been some of the concern. I think it's interesting when Phil Berger says that people are being emotional rather than factual. I think there is a lot of study about the efficacy of gambling for economies. These do not tend to be high paying jobs, for example, with a lot of good benefits, but I guess we'll see those discussions play out in the future.
This compromise, after a long, long couple of months of talking about this, was reached on Tuesday night. The budget was released on Wednesday. The House voted yes last night. The Senate will vote sometime today, Friday, but Representative Deb Butler, a Democrat from New Hanover County, is not happy about the turnaround time.
We are going to vote on it tomorrow at 10 a.m. So if you subtract even 5 hours sleep and then you work back from when we actually get it, it leaves very little time to cover a $30 billion budget and 600 pages.
She has a point, but they've been working on this thing for months. Have they not read it in pieces over time?
Well, as you said, Mike, this was only released to non-insiders on Tuesday, and that's been the big complaint here. There are things in here that people have never seen before, and you know, there's no time for debate on it. And I think that's something, that's what the Democrats are pushing back on.
Okay. And they are, the Republicans are in control of all this. So these debates have really been among House and Senate Republicans over the last several months. The House had larger raises for teachers and for state employees than the final bill will have. But what will those employees be receiving when this budget passes and it's signed by the governor, if it's signed by the governor?
I think that the headline number is the 7% that teachers and state employees, most state employees, will receive. 9% for the school bus drivers. Of course, we know the shortages for both school bus drivers and teachers. And as you said, Mike, I think an important part of this to consider is that House Speaker Tim Moore has said he hopes to come back next year in the short session and bump up those raises in the second year. Remember, this is a two-year budget cycle. So that is certainly something to watch.
So state employees are going to receive 4% this year, 3% next. Teachers would get an average of 7%, which includes the scheduled raises they get based on experience. That means starting pay increases from $37,000 to $39,000. And the top of the pay scale for teachers with more than 25 years of experience would increase from $54,000 to $55,100. And Kim Mackey, who is a 17-year veteran teacher at Wake County Schools, who teaches economics and personal finance, so ought to know something about this, says this is not a great deal for teachers.
The whole point of making money is to buy stuff. So you need to add in inflation. And teachers like me, who are veterans, are likely going to be able to put 2% less in our cart than the year before.
Shamaria, what if anything are you hearing from teachers locally about the potential of these raises?
I can say from the Facebook groups I'm in, teachers I've spoken to, even folks who are at the top, like some CMS school board members, no one is particularly happy with what it looks like, especially when it looks when you're looking at veteran teachers. When you get a job, you want to know what your long-term output looks like. And if at the end of your 20-year career, all you're making is $55,000 or $60,000, well, it stops you from wanting to be in that career in totality. And that's what we're seeing.
That makes perfect sense to me. And I think it makes perfect sense to almost anybody who might be listening today. Does it not make sense, the legislators capping pay at $55,100 after 25 years of experience?
I can't answer for them, but I do know that this is a conversation that's happening locally, and that's why you have local dollars. Like, for example, Mecklenburg County gives CMS extra money on top of what the state is giving teachers because they understand it's a real problem, but they just can't seem to communicate that effectively, at least, or they're just saying that maybe the legislators don't care.
Eric?
Well, I think to Shamaria's point, one thing that shows the tone deafness is that they did not revive the supplemental pay for having a master's degree. I mean, if that's just the lowest hanging fruit imaginable. They couldn't even do that. And think how long all of us are different ages, but I bet all of us throughout our lives have heard one thing, right? Teachers deserve higher pay. I mean, we talk about this over and over and over, and it really doesn't move very much.
Where was I going to talk about? Oh, the teachers are getting 55.1. They're capping out at 55.1, 7% raise. But just like in the private sector, the governor in this budget is about to receive a 23% pay raise. State Supreme Court justices are getting an 18% pay raise. The governor makes just under $167,000. Does this make for bad optics, or do they care?
Well, I guess in the case of the governor, what you would say is the governor is one who has pushed for higher teacher pay than what the legislature wants or has approved. But yes, Mike, I mean, the larger point is, of course, it looks bad. It's analogous to the UAW strike and the workers saying, hey, look, we'd like 30-40%. And then the company comes back and says, that's crazy. Why would you say that? And they say, you know why? Because the executives have had their compensation go up 40% in the past 4 years. So this is the same conversation being had in a number of industries across the country. But as I say, I can't think of any other sector that has had more discussion and more sort of head nodding across the country that, yeah, we really need to give them more. And it just seems to always get kicked down the road. Hmm.
One thing that's in the budget are tax cuts. taxes pay for things, you know. I just want to let that people know that in case they haven't put that pathway together. And that tax cuts are one of the things that cause budget negotiations to drag on for so long because and they would be tied to the state's revenue levels. They would not kick in if there are shortfalls. And this falls in line with House Speaker Tim Moore's philosophy.
I'm for tax relief anywhere we can across the board to allow more people to keep more of the money that they earn instead of giving it to the government.
So the government uses tax dollars for services. We know the DMV is short-staffed. We know that NCDOT doesn't have what they need for roads. We've just talked about education. Well, according to many, it's been chronically underfunded in North Carolina. Is anyone connecting these dots?
Well, I think they're connecting them in different ways, Mike. This is certainly throughout the two terms of Governor Roy Cooper, we have seen this divergence in economic philosophy, which plays out with the parties in general, which is cutting taxes benefits the economy more. That is the Republican mantra. The Democrats, and certainly what Cooper has said, is yes, lower taxes, but moderate those cuts and don't put as much money in the rainy day fund so that we can take care of some of these other issues such as education and roads. And so that's where we stand. That's, I would say, wherever you fall on those issues, that's why elections and voting matter. That's the stance I would take.
David.
And Mike, I think connecting the dots is why we're here, and you're doing a great job of that right now. But I want to point to something that Eric mentioned, which is the rainy day fund or the reserves or whatever you want to call it. I can't remember what the latest numbers are, but it's been in the $5 to $6 billion range in recent years. And that's money that could be spent on road projects or to bring up teacher salaries and that sort of thing. And that's something that the governor and Democrats have been pointing out consistently. This budget looks completely different from the one that Governor Cooper put in months ago. And that's just the way it is with the way the power falls in the legislature right now.
So this is a budget bill that will likely pass today in the Senate and then be sent to the governor for his signature. And there are other monetary aspects to this budget bill. But the budget bill is kind of an omnibus bill because there are lots of things in there that have nothing to do with the budget. Among them, on page 427 of this 600-page budget, how did a proposal to allow Supreme Court justices and Court of Appeals judges to carry concealed guns in court find its way into a budget bill?
Well, I would like to go back to what David said. He was answering your question about why Democrats in this particular case, but it happens on both sides, depending on who's in power, why people get upset when budgets or other legislation move really quickly and there's not a chance to review it. And it's because even though they've been talking about all these issues for months and months, things like this all of a sudden appear and there you go.
And this is the privilege of the leadership. I mean, yes. A number of these things were bills that didn't go anywhere during the regular part of the session. And, you know, the budget is something we have to pass. And so they put it in the budget. It has to pass.
And it's an up or down vote. You can't take things out to make this go away. It's an up or all or nothing at all. We'll come back and talk about some of the other things in this budget that is likely to pass this morning in a moment at Charlotte Talks on 90.7. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. It's the local news roundup. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Shamaria Morrison, education reporter at WCNC-TV. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. And Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal, talking about the budget. that passed the House last night will go to a vote this morning in the Senate. Lawmakers had been talking about opening opportunity scholarships to everybody. The scholarships offset the cost of attending private schools of your choice. This compromise budget does call for expanding those scholarships, but by how much, Shamaria?
A lot of money over the next decade. It'll be over almost $500 million, so just over that $500 million mark. But in the most immediate, it's going to double from what it was last year. So a lot of money, a few hundred million dollars that's going to be going towards these opportunity scholarships.
And these would no longer be limited to only low-income families with this budget. And this, along with pay raises that she sees as insufficient, troubles New Hanover County Representative Deb Butler.
Oh, there's a multitude of sins in it. All you need to do is ask a teacher or a state employee or a retiree or perhaps a taxpayer who is going to now pay for a rich family's private education for their children.
So I'm sure she is not alone among Democrats. Do we know how they voted in the House last night, how Democrats are likely to vote in the Senate today? And does it matter, David?
I haven't looked at the vote totals, but leadership put out a press release saying it was bipartisan. So I'm guessing that at least a few Democrats voted for this. And that's where we stand.
There are also a number of power grabs in this budget. Hidden in there is what appears to be another move to further weaken the office of the governor. The State Bureau of Investigation would no longer be housed within the governor's administration. What is this about?
So the Republicans have been concerned that the Cooper administration, they've been alleging that the Cooper administration may be using the SBI for its own purposes. And so they've taken that out of the governor's office in hopes of, putting that to rest.
They've also made some adjustments to how the presidents of the community college system would be confirmed by the legislature. And they've got legislators picking judges at certain levels. Also, we already have in this state, as in many others, an electric vehicle fee. It's $140 that owners of electric vehicles pay every year because they don't pay the tax on gasoline, and the gasoline tax helps support road construction. This budget bill wants to increase that fee from $140 to $180. If you own an ICE car, a car that burns gas or diesel, you pay taxes based on how you use the car. Why isn't this mileage based, David? Why is it just a flat fee for somebody who may never drive that electric car?
I think it's easier to do this way, just having a flat fee. It also, I think it's a little bit of a tweak by conservatives against people who own electric cars.
Because state inspection takes your mileage every year. They could easily say, well, he drove this many miles that year, or she drove that many miles that year, and this is what we're charging for it.
Again, it's an administrative nightmare, I think, for them to, decide, does Mike Collins drive 20,000 miles a year? What does Eric drive? It's hard to do.
Well, and I think the other thing, I agree with David's answer, but I think also, or I know also, that the fuel tax just is not generating nearly enough. Right. They've been talking about this for years because cars are more fuel efficient. And beyond the potential conservative tweak, Mike, I don't think they really know what to do. I mean, they've studied this, they've talked about it. And when I say they, I mean political leaders, transportation leaders. They really haven't found a way out of this to fill the funding gap.
And one other point, Mike, and this is in the budget somewhere as well. I think Mecklenburg County is the only county left that has inspections for vehicles that are somewhat older. So, it's not something that they're tracking at the moment.
And there's another provision that's getting pushback from environmental groups in the state. They are objecting to a provision that would prohibit city and county governments from banning plastic shopping bags, as well as plastic cups, bottles, and packaging. Are there cities and towns that are considering this or have already done it?
There's a movement in Asheville right now in Buncombe County to put some kind of a rule in place like this. And this does seem to be partly a response to that. I think there's others that would consider it. And this is a big shutdown of that whole movement. So,
and Eric, Charlotte is actively involved in trying to get this tennis complex built down by the River District. It's a project out of I think, Charleston, South Carolina developer. And they also own the rights to this international tennis tournament that is currently played in Cincinnati. And they, of course, want to move that tournament to this new tennis facility if it is eventually built. But the clock is ticking on this. And there was some fear that delays on the budget would cause time to run out. That hasn't happened. And there are provisions in this budget to partially fund that, correct?
Correct. And I think overall, Charlotte, backers of this event should be pretty pleased that they were able to find or able to secure $20 million from the state to add to the $95 million that the city and the county have approved. However, there's always a but, right? The caveat is that gets you to $115 million. The structure of the proposal is two-thirds by this Charleston company and one-third by the public sector for a $400 million tennis complex that would be built to house this tournament. That is roughly $270 million for the private company, $130 million on the public side. We don't have $130 million. So how do they make that up? Do they have to make that up? We don't really know. We haven't heard a lot other than Malcolm Graham, the city councilman who's been most vocal about landing this tournament. He's just said that he's happy the state is chipping in.
One thing that is not in the budget is an extension for the hospitality tax for Panther Stadium renovations. Has the legislature been watching the games or something? Was this a surprise?
So now I guess the question is, what will come first, the tax extension or a Panthers victory? Because it looks like this will now pass in October, I'm told by Representative John Bradford, who's a Mecklenburg Republican, who's part of the Finance Committee. He says that it was easier to move this out of the budget, put it with a bill that rolls up a number of hotel occupancy taxes. So they put it all in one bill. And as I say, he thinks it will be done by October.
And there are about 600,000 people who should be very happy when this budget passes, because what is in it is the expansion of Medicaid. 600,000 people stand to benefit from that. Many of them were on the temporary Medicaid rolls during the pandemic and have now cycled off. And many of those people were in mid-treatment when they lost that coverage. So how quickly might they be reinstated? How quickly can those who need this Medicaid expansion benefit from it?
You know, Mike, state health officials have been planning to do this, and they have had a couple of different press conferences over the recent months saying, it looks like we're not going to do it by October. The latest is that they don't think they'll be able to get it in place until the new year. So it's still going to be a little bit longer.
So it's probably a foregone conclusion that this budget will pass the Senate this morning and then be sent to the governor for his signature. Is the governor likely to sign it? And if he doesn't sign it, will they just simply override his veto? Is there any chance at all that this government, that this budget will not pass?
I don't think there's any chance at all. I think it, you know, as you, as we heard in that clip you played from Speaker Moore, it could delay it a few weeks if the governor vetoes it. This is a bit of a difficult decision for the governor because he has talked about Medicaid expansion for years and years and years, and he has more recently discussed the urgency of getting it in place, as you just asked David about. So I wonder whether that will sway him to sign it.
The budget has been under discussion now for months, which is why we led with it. But we probably should have led with something else that's in the budget. We kind of buried the lead here because there is a new provision in this budget bill that is, to many people, very concerning. It exempts lawmakers from the public records law and could give them full discretion to determine which of their records are public. David, put that into English.
Yeah, so basically what they've done is they've exempted themselves from a law that has to be followed by the rest of state government. And specifically, this would be in practical terms, keeping emails. Which emails do they keep? Which records do they keep from their correspondence with committees, with state government agencies and that sort of thing. I can put it into even more specific terms. I did a story in July about how the State Home Builders Association was able to get a bill passed to hold off, delay new energy efficiency rules by the state Building Code Council, and we got correspondence. I worked with a group called the Energy Policy Institute, and we got correspondence between lawmakers, state legislative staff, and the Home Builders Association that showed a direct connection where basically this bill was being negotiated and written with the help of the Home Builders Association. Under these new rules, we won't be able to get those emails if the lawmakers choose to destroy them before they're made public. So,
Shamari, I think you wanted to chime in on this.
I did, because I want to talk about how North Carolina as a whole, the open records law, is very unique. I've been in other states where there are a lot of things that are a lot more open, and this just doesn't matter to journalism. It matters to taxpayers to know that if you wanted to see what was happening, you're not going to be able to do it anymore. And so when you see these rights being chipped away on what you can watch, what you can look at, and what you can't, you should start to worry, because if this happens up to the legislator, what happens next? What's the next steps of that? So
I'm just curious how duly elected government officials in a democracy can justify this new provision, which says, quote, "The custodian of any General Assembly record shall determine in the custodian's discretion whether a record is a public record." Alexandria.
Some of the Republican leaders made some statements about how this had to do with archiving, and that, but to me, this doesn't mince words. This is very clear. And I think Tim Warren made a statement about how the lawyers will be able to define this. And I think that they'll be able to do a pretty good job if anybody wants to fight this. It very clearly says that they get to decide, they get to pick and choose what is and isn't a public record. And public record law is already very vague. We don't have any timeline for getting public records. So does sometimes this, we're submitting these requests and we're waiting months.
Does this go up against FOIA, which is a federal law? The what's FOIA stand for? It stands for
Freedom of Information Act.
Thank you very much. I couldn't bring it up.
Those of us that file them all the time.
does that fly in the face of that?
Well, they are looked at differently because each state has different ways that they do open records. So you have FOIA, which covers the federal government, and then you have on a state level what covers state record, and so there is no type of law that supersedes it per se.
So this move appears to fall right in line with other recent power grabs by the Republican-controlled legislature, moves that had they been successful would have made them the most important governmental organization in the state with no oversight. And right now, evidently, they have become the most powerful legislature in the country. Would it be an oversimplification to say that if this provision goes into effect, and it will, that it will be nearly impossible for the media, for the public, or any other interested party to exercise oversight? And if that's the case, is this headed to the United States Supreme Court?
It would be a big surprise if this was not challenged by somebody, whether it's a news organization. We don't exactly have the deep pockets to take something all the way to the Supreme Court, but I would expect news organizations and other organizations. This is also used by citizen groups, in my world, environmental groups also use it. And so it's the kind of thing that it's a tool that we have right now, and having that go away would make our jobs a lot more difficult.
The Washington Post's slogan is "Democracy dies in darkness." Unintended or not, this is a step in that direction and another step down the path toward autocracy, which is something the GOP seems to be hell-bent on following. Speaking of democracy, another book has been added to the banned books list at CMS. Shamaria, what is it?
It's a book. It's a children's book. It's called Red, A Crayon Story.
Red, A Crayon's Story? Okay.
Yes. It's called Red, The Color Red, A Crayon Story. Yes, it's about a crayon who's red. At least that's what we think. So if I can explain what the book showed, it's supposed to be for kindergartners. That's who's supposed to read the book. And it's basically a red crayon. It's labeled red, but you can clearly see, the kids can see that the crayon is blue. And it kind of takes this journey of, oh, it can't color anything that is supposed to be red, let's say like a sunset. But finally, it gets to color something that's supposed to be blue, like a blue whale. And then it figures out, oh, I am blue. I just have this label of being red. It's supposed to be talking about accepting your differences and treating everyone the same, no matter who you think you are in identity. But it has been said that it is representing something else. And I'm sure you have a follow-up question for me, so I'll wait before
What is it said? What did they say it represents?
They think that it is alluding to gender identity, and that's why it has been challenged under the new state law, which is the Parents' Bill of Rights, where there have been some parent complaints. We don't know how many, and we don't know who did it, but there were complaints about it.
Well, that was my next question. This is a part of the Parents' Bill of Rights bill. A CMS spokesperson said, quote, "We received concerns from parents and guardians about the book and about its age appropriateness." How many parents challenged it was going to be my question. You say we don't know. Why don't we know?
CMS has not told us. We just know it's
why
in
not?
The classroom. We also do not know. Well, you know what? I'm going to actually follow up today to see if they will tell us how many. We may have to do an open records request. But we
do
also
it quickly.
Don't know if something happened to the yes, I will. Listen, I got you, Mike.
Here's my other question. If parents can say, we don't like this book, and they can successfully have it removed, can other parents who disagree with that challenge that decision?
So to be honest, I don't know if it works in the reverse. What I do know is there is a way for when these books are challenged, like it can become, if there is a process that CMS can go through to see if the book can be taken out of all schools. So that may happen. We're looking to see if it does, but I will tell you, I got a lot of messages after that story aired about, like, how can just complaints have a whole book taken out? Where does the process happen when we looked at the book, challenged the book? And this book has been challenged in other places as well. But it's a slippery slope when you can have just some parents complain and the book gets taken out with no kind of follow-up to what the book entails and have other opinions on if the book should stay or go. But there is an avenue to make that happen. We just don't know if that avenue was taken yet.
This is happening across the country. Mostly by conservative-leaning individuals. In Catawba County, school leaders just voted 4-3 to restrict Tiffany Jackson's book, Monday's Not Coming, for students under 18. This was put up for objection by a woman who has submitted or requested that 25 books be removed from school libraries in Catawba County. She's the co-founder of Mama Bears of Catawba County, and she happens to be on the Catawba County School Board. We're going to talk about that and more when we come back. It's the Local News Roundup every Friday here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the Local News Roundup. David Borax is here from WFAE News. Alexandria Sands, reporter for Axios Charlotte. Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal. And Shamari Morrison, education reporter for WCNC-TV. We're talking about books being banned here and around the country. And in Catawba County, another one was just removed. Monday's Not Coming. It's been, restricted to student and nobody under 18, which is pretty much everybody in the school system, can read this book in that library. They can go to a public library or a bookstore and get it. So that makes you wonder why this is effective at all. But what is this book, Monday's Not Coming, about?
It is about a little girl. Monday is the name of a student, and her friend notices that Monday is not coming to school. By the end of the book, we realize Monday has not come to school because Monday, unfortunately, was killed by her family. But in the breadth of the book, there are instances, you know, that talk about regular teen things, like it talks a little bit about sex. It has profanity in it. And so things that we know happen in teens' lives, in addition to the main premise of the book being about a girl named Monday who is missing but eventually is dead.
Many people testified at this hearing, and one of them was a high school student who raised her phone and said, this is my phone. I can see anything that I want on this phone, and yet you won't let me see a book. I can't hold a book in my hand. As I said, this is among the 25 books that this individual, Michelle Teague, who's the co-founder of Mama Bears of Catawba County, have put up for examination. Trouble is, there seems to be an ethical violation here by all rights, because she's on the school board and she gets to sit in judgment of objections that she is raising. She's won a few, she's lost a few, but among the books that she suggested should be removed are Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, which you can watch on television, Toni Morrison's The Bluest Eye, which is recognized as a classic contemporary work, and Khaled Hosseini's The Kite Runner. We've interviewed that author. There's nothing, I can't see anything wrong with that book.
Yeah, and Anne Doss Helms, who did the reporting on this, she did a wonderful job. And I think the big question becomes, ethical versus legal are two different things. And it is up to, you know, a school board itself to figure out what that means. And that same school board member in question voted against her being taken away from the vote. So it's kind of a thing where, you know, you have to figure out who your representatives are, because again, to Eric's point when he said elections matter, this is an instance of elections mattering who you have on your school board, because they have a direct relation. And you also talked about them being able to go check out the book at their other regular library. Well, regular libraries are also having books banned and groups are coming in. We saw it happen in York County. And so this is not just something that's happening in school libraries, it's libraries outright.
Yeah,
Mike, I just want to point out that Michelle Teague actually filed these before she was on the school board and then got elected to the school board. And so now they are working their way through this multi-layered appeal process and working their way up to the school board. And she's presenting the case for them and then turning around and sitting in her seat and voting on it. And that does raise some serious questions. She says that she has been told that it's not wrong for her to vote on it. I think this is a situation where folks in the community are going to have to decide what they think about this situation.
Seems to me that if you can't see the ethical violation in that, you should go back to school. Speaking of school and going to school, absenteeism has been a problem since the pandemic in schools across the country and also at CMS. And this year they have said they were going to crack down on this. Am I right about this, that the number of students being absent, Shamaria, has begun to decline?
Yes, you are right about that. It has declined. And because a lot of the reasons why students were absent was during the pandemic. So I think it made sense that so many students were absent. But I don't want to make it seem as if before the pandemic students were absent, because they were absent for a number of reasons. And the state of North Carolina has had a longstanding goal to reduce the amount of absenteeism in schools all throughout the state.
So teachers can't teach if students aren't in the classroom. And Felisa Simpson, the principal at Blythe Elementary, which is a magnet school, echoed that sentiment.
Attendance is really big here with us. And so students are loving to come to school each day. If they're in the seats, we're going to get them what they need.
So what have they been doing, or what has happened to result in decreasing absenteeism?
Well, I think a bigger emphasis has been put on what the law says. Again, some reporting by Anne Doss Helms last year revealed that the last superintendent had not been sending students or referring to the district attorney when a student had been absent for more than 10 days. There is a state law that says if there's a student that has been absent for a long reoccurring time, I don't know the exact number, that the district attorney is supposed to be looped in, because parents, they can get taken to court for this. Students can also have some consequences. What CMS has said is that it's going to make sure that its policy is followed, but before it gets to the district attorney, they have some steps in between to figure out what's happening. They are going to the doorsteps of parents and things of that sort to figure out why students are missing, because students aren't always missing because, oh, they don't want to come to school. There could be something that's happening at home. There could be a chronic illness. And so there are a lot of reasons students may be missing, but they have to do a better job on figuring it out, because again, if you're not in school, well, you can't learn.
So there's something else we want to talk about before we move on to other things, and that is the fact that CMS intends to float this $2.5 billion bond package, which would fund the 30 different projects, and we now know what it will cost taxpayers, and that number is?
It's a penny in additional property tax in 3 years, 2025, 2028, and 2029, and of course that's per $100 of valuation. Anyone who owns a home is very familiar with these numbers.
Yeah,
that's, and that about could $10 a month if you own a home that's $400,000.
Yes.
That's, so
yes.
it could be a significant hit on your property tax. Is this going to be on the November ballot?
Yes.
And so how will people react to this? Have school bonds ever not passed?
2005. Yes, go ahead, Shamaria.
Yes, they have before in the past. And what happens when they don't pass? You restart the process again, and you put it on the next ballot and hope there's a better chance. I remember when we just seen that election that you all were talking about on the last Charlotte Talks, how it was such a low amount of people who came. The school board chair, Elise Dashew, actually at a school board meeting that night, that we're afraid that there's not going to be enough people who come, and we have a small amount of people who decide if these school bonds go through or not. And so this matters to them a lot. They don't want to have to do this again because it delays what happens for those school construction projects, and it may get more expensive.
Less than 5% of people turned out for the municipal primary. It's an off-year election again in November, and as you point out, elections matter. It hits your pocketbook, it hits your rights, and many other things happen as a result of elections. I'm not sure why Charlotte has among the state's lowest voter turnouts, period, end of sentence. Well, speaking of school, Charlotte has always wanted a law school, Alexandria, especially once the for-profit Charlotte School of Law closed its doors several years ago. Enter Elon University, not Elon Musk, but Elon University. They have opened a part-time law school, or will be, with plans to start classes in the fall. Did anybody know about this in advance? This came out of the clear blue sky to me.
Yeah, I think, well, there was some word going on around it. I think the Business NC had broke the story because of an online posting where they had applied for to the Bar Association for this university. So they did kind of steal their thunder on that. And then, you know, a few days later, we hear that they're opening up their regional center and they're going to have a big special announcement. So we could kind of guess this is going to be this law school that they had applied for.
So this has been described as a part-time law school. What's a part-time law school? What is that?
Yeah, this is interesting. So, I guess a lot of metro areas have this where people are in different stages of life, a lot of working professionals. Charlotte has a lot of young people who maybe want to get into law, but they don't want to like completely uproot their life and dedicate all this time. So this is going to be, it's called a flex program. And in 4 years, taking night classes, being really flexible with professors, you can get your law degree.
And this is going to be located in South End, is that right?
Yeah, it's kind of funny that it's Elon because the floor they're on was previously leased by a rival, which is an electric vehicle company. So
we're going full circle here.
Full circle. Well, yeah. This has been, speaking of electric vehicles and auto workers, this has been the summer of strikes. They're on strike. Many of the writers and actors in Hollywood are on strike, hitting the picket lines.
The workers united
will never be defeated.
Well, those are workers at Charlotte Douglas International. They aren't on strike, but they did march on Tuesday at the airport's entrance. Is this preliminary to a strike, Eric, or are they merely part of National Action Day, which was Tuesday?
Well, we're not sure about the strike part, but they're certainly part of, this has been a growing movement. There's been a lot of talk about airport workers, not only in Charlotte, but across the country, particularly with the extreme temperatures this summer. And we've had workers, including at Charlotte, saying that they have fainted from heat exhaustion. Yeah. They have not been provided water, that they don't have enough access to relief from the work conditions. And so that is part of what's driving this.
Many of these were employees for Jetstream Ground Services, which is employed by American Airlines to clean the cabins of its passenger jets. And one of their employees, Avon Johnson, says they want higher pay, which is now $14 to $15 an hour. And this is interesting, more drinking water and proper air conditioning for all of their break rooms, saying it can get really exhausting when you have to clean back-to-back planes.
We'd be having to do like 20 planes a day sometimes. You know, it'd be 90 degrees, 100 degrees outside.
You know, this is something most of us don't think about very often. This seems like a reasonable request. Why would they have to march for that to be answered.
I mean, again, I don't have the specific reason, but I will say that anyone who follows the airline industry, one of the tenets is to get those planes turned around quickly so that they go back up in the air so that you, you know, boost your revenue, obviously. Go ahead, David.
Just real quick here, I just want to point out, I did a story this summer about farm workers in North Carolina, and there are no statewide or even national protections for outdoor workers. There's no rules, so you got to go to your company and get it.
Climate change and increasing heat is also affecting the energy grid. That's no secret. We know that. But now Duke Energy has a report of its own, a study of its own, that estimates that by 2050, up to 80% of Duke's transmission lines could be at risk from temperatures hotter than they were designed for. They were designed for 104 degrees at the top end. Is the challenge here the time it would take to upgrade these lines, or the cost of upgrading those lines, or even can it be done?
Well, just back up a second. The report also found that a lot of substations are at risk from flooding. So this
underwater.
Was looking at climate risks. And in the case of the power lines, basically that's a rating on the line. It says we think that they can carry the maximum amount of power up to that temperature. But with temperatures going higher than that, the concern is that the companies will have to, they call it derating the lines, and they will not be able to pump as much electricity through them and will have shortages. And so it is a question of either upgrading those lines or redoing the system so that it won't matter if the temperatures are hotter. There's lots that they can do. Now, Duke is working on a lot of this already. They have already moved some substations, and they are looking at this question of transmission lines as well. So it's something that's looking out towards the end of the century here, but it's something that they need to prepare for.
Speaking of climate change, very quickly, Charlotte is joining in on a national effort to combat climate change by promoting smart surfaces.
Smart surfaces are surfaces that reduce the need for energy to heat and cool structures.
That's Sarah Hazel. She's the city's chief sustainability and resiliency officer. Charlotte does have a goal of powering all city vehicles and buildings without fossil fuels by 2030, and this brings another tool to that toolkit.
We're talking about things like solar, reflective pavements, green roofs. We're talking about things like trees or carbon sequestering concrete, our parking lots, our roofs, how we're using our city streets, how we're using our city sidewalks.
Have we started doing this yet, David?
Charlotte is doing this. They do have a policy of trying to do this with all new construction. So I visited a fire station on Clanton Road where they have both a concrete driveway and parking area, which is a lot cooler than black tar or asphalt. They've also got a light-colored roof on that building. And that's the sort of thing they're going to be doing going forward in order to try and reduce temperatures in these neighborhoods.
Earlier this year, Alexandria, the YMCA of Greater Charlotte announced its intention to close the Johnston Y in NoDa and sell it to a developer. It was set to close at the end of the year. That may not happen now. What changed?
Yeah, the YMCA told reporters and the community yesterday that they are no longer under contract. It seemed like a developer called Republic Metropolitan was making plans towards putting up a mixed-use project on the site. And I guess for reasons having to do with the market, the development is, or the contract just fell through right now. So, you know, the Y has been struggling financially for a while. And they're still going to be exploring options. A sale could happen eventually, but for now, the Y and NoDa will remain open.
Well, we had to talk about this at some point. The time has come. As of the Panthers' Monday night game, we're 0-2 on the season, falling to New Orleans 20-17. It now appears that we're going to play the Seahawks in Seattle on Sunday. Linebacker Shaq Thompson is out. So is our quarterback. What does all this mean, Eric? Quickly.
Doesn't look real good, particularly short week, Mike, playing on Monday night. And then you go to the West Coast. So Coach Frank Reich says that he sees signs that things are getting better. But I think a lot of the fans, as you heard, a smattering of boos, are a little frustrated. So they need to get things turned around sooner rather than later.
Yeah, we lost all of the pregame games or the preseason games, and now we've lost two on the season. And yet, as you point out, despite our losing record so far, Frank Reich, our new head coach, has said our team is on the verge of something big. It puts a song in your heart.
That this could be the start of something.
This could be the heart of something. This could be the start of something.
Thank you, Stephen Eady. It's also thank you to, boy, that sounds old, doesn't it? And thanks to David Borax from WFAE News, Alexandria Sands from Axios, Charlotte, Shamari Morrison, who was bopping to that, from WCNC-TV, and Eric Spanberg, managing editor of the Charlotte Business Journal.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.